There's a small online movement called Love Has Won, and it has carried a strange fascination for some time. Basically, it's a digital cult, and it teaches about energy healing and past life reincarnations and galactic starships. It's been the subject of documentaries and podcasts and an HBO series that tells its strange and tragic end, where police officers find this mummified blue-tinged body wrapped in Christmas lights and glitter makeup. It was a woman whose followers called Mother. She's the main character in journalist Leah Sottile's book. Her name was Amy Carlson.
Amy Carlson was really a daughter of America's heartland. She was someone who grew up in the Midwest. She moved to Texas as a child and was raised in the suburbs of Dallas. Beautiful girl, really good grades, had a great upbringing. After she graduates from high school, she really tries to do her best to make her way in the world. But what that means is she keeps her job at McDonald's and she becomes a manager. This is not quite what Amy Carlson thought that she would become. And, you know, as life is wont to do, she encounters a series of hurdles and obstacles in her life. She has three different children by three different men. She struggles with alcohol. Life is just really coming at her in a way that maybe she didn't expect. So around Thanksgiving of 2007, she and her family gets together for dinner at a Mexican restaurant outside Houston. And while she's at dinner, she all of a sudden in the middle of the meal just says, "I need to go." And she pushes away from the table and leaves. She was going to be leaving her life and her identity as Amy Carlson entirely. Amy had fallen into these rabbit holes online. She'd been interested in astrology. She'd been interested in ideas about aliens. And she'd found online forums around something called light workers. This idea that, you know, people have hybrid spirits with aliens. And, you know, as strange as it sounds, she had found a community of people that she felt had understood her. In particular, she had met a man named Amareth White Eagle, who she called Am. And that night, when she pushed away from the table at the restaurant, she was essentially going to leave her life, to leave her children, and go live with Amareth and create herself into a new person. That new person would be called Mother God. She would start to think of herself as the embodiment of the planet. And over time, she would really start to assemble a whole ideology, a whole religious ideology around herself. I think a lot of people don't realize that her story started as a very seemingly normal person and ended up in a wildly different place. As a journalist who covers the fringes of life in the Western United States, I've heard a lot about different New Age groups, New Age kind of culty groups over the years. And I'd heard about this group that Amy Carlson ended up starting called Love Has Won. And, you know, there's just a lot of rhetoric around this woman, around this person who said that she was Mother God and gave these really wild online live streams that didn't really make a lot of sense. You know, for me, there was something about her that was just really compelling, and I just wanted to know what creates a person who thinks that they're a god. So the book ends up being kind of a quest to understand how someone with seemingly no religion creates a religion where they're at the center.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Leah Sottile is with us. Her book is called Blazing Eye Sees All, and it explores the rise and fall of the Love Has Won digital cult. We had Sottile on the show a few years ago talking about her book, When the Moon Turns to Blood, where she dug into that story of Lori Vallow and Chad Daybell. You might remember they're the couple who twisted their Mormon beliefs into these violent fantasies. So Tilly told us she's proud of that book, but she also said, personally, it was damaging.
You know, I really came up in journalism with a mentality that, like, you don't feel anything. You can really take on these hard emotions and translate them to the public. But it turns out I do feel things. It's kind of ignorant to think that you don't. And so when I finished the Daybell story, I came away just so disturbed by what I'd learned, really unsettled. And I thought, you know, I think I'm good on this extremism thing. There's a lot more to me as a writer and reporter that I can dive into. I had personally been really interested in New Age ideas. It's something that I just noticed a lot where I live in Portland. There's just a lot of, you know, talk of tarot cards, and there are stores where you can buy crystals and things like that. And that's always been the case living in Oregon. I've always noticed that stuff. So I thought, oh, this is interesting. You know, I'm interested personally in this, but I'm also interested in learning what this culture is all about because it's so prevalent. I unintentionally stepped backward into another story of extremism. And I remember when that happened, when I was doing my research, which was extensive, sort of coming home and talking to my husband and saying, I can't believe this, but I think I found another extremism story and now I have to do it. You know, it made me feel a little bit like the conspiracy theorist with the string and the cards on the wall, like it all connects. But I started to understand how much closer this culture was to cultures that really seem so unfamiliar to me, like the Daybells.
It's interesting talking about tarot cards, just looking. So you sort of started thinking about the beliefs in tarot cards and the kind of the culture around it. And I wondered, what was it that you saw there that you had these people, in many cases, just really well-intentioned, earnest people who believed in things that reached beyond the rational. But once they're there, once they're willing to kind of suspend the rational, they're vulnerable to be manipulated or for those beliefs to get more and more kind of outrageous. Is that a fair way to describe what you were saying?
I think so. You know, during COVID, you know, we were all kind of spending our time doing different things. And I just took a lot of online classes. I started taking classes on the history, the art history behind tarot cards, and was really compelled by it. You know, having grown up in the Catholic Church and really been fed sort of stories about the occult and how evil things were, I was actually really surprised to learn that tarot was just this old card game out of Italy, you know, from the 13th century. You know, it had this really interesting legacy in history. So on that regard, I was able to see that there is something really valuable as, you know, pieces of art, as a lineage, as a culture with this game. And yet, I could also see the ways that some of my fellow students in these classes seem to really be putting their hopes and fears into these cards. It was COVID, you know, everything was scary. We didn't really know what was happening. I could see that there was almost like an alternative spiritual practice happening. And I wondered, you know, if I could be subjected to that, if there was something that maybe, you know, maybe I wouldn't be sucked up into a group like Chad Daybell's, but maybe there would be something here that would be attractive to a person like me. What I started to realize was that, you know, some of these teachers that I was taking classes from and scholars, they were really careful with the way that they spoke about tarot cards because they realized from experience that people really are willing to hang up their beliefs and say, tell me my future, tell me what's going to happen. So I think it was mostly just in observing the care that my teachers were taking in saying, like, look, this is all just an idea. These are almost like a philosophy. But noticing how vulnerable people were in that moment, that's when I was like, okay, you could really do some damage to a person here, I think, if you had nefarious intentions and you just wanted to take people's money.
Well, Amy, as you already mentioned, she is, I mean, she, you know, there were some bumps and some childhood difficulties for sure. But they end up, the family, in this suburb of Dallas in what you say is this sort of upper middle class neighborhood. You know, she gets her own car, this purple Honda Civic when she turns 16. She's independent. She's confident. And as you said, the family wasn't particularly religious, but Amy is interested in probably tarot cards. I mean, you mentioned zodiac signs and astrology charts. I mean, she believed that her weekly horoscope was going to give her a sense of what was going to happen. So what's going on with Amy at this point? What is she looking for? What is she seeing in all of that?
Well, from talking to her family, to her children, I think that they've all kind of come to an understanding that Amy was seeking something bigger. Amy thought she should be famous. She should be famous. She should be wealthy. She should be revered. And maybe that component is the thing that she most wanted, was a sense of reverence that was bigger than just her children loving her. It was a sense of like a goddess, like, you know, in the ways I think anybody reveres celebrities or singers that they love or things like that. You know, I think maybe she wanted that and then took it to the next level. So at the point that she was, you know, really interested in astrology and her horoscope, you know, I don't know that there was anything particularly nefarious happening there. But what I do see, like in any extremist ideology, is she started to on-ramp herself to level up to new ideas and new things. And pretty quickly, I think Amy was stumbling into spaces online where she was seeing conspiracy theories, and she was seeing people saying, you know, that common language of like, this is what the media doesn't want you to know. We on this online forum have a better sense of the greater forces controlling the world. So I think that Amy sought knowledge that would sort of give her a level up on just, you know, looking at horoscopes. And she took things further. And I think that there's always a sort of funnel like pipeline with these ideas. And that's what I think she was starting to fall into.
She has this moment where early on in all of this, she hears this voice that tells her that she is one day going to become the president of the United States. Mm-hmm. Which tells you what's appealing about that? I mean, if she's someone who wants to be famous, I mean, she wants to have a musical career for a while. She wants to be on stage. She wants to perform. Somebody's telling you you could be as famous as the most well-known person in the world.
Right.
There must be some appeal to all of that.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's hard to know if that, like in all things in spirituality, it's hard to know if she really heard that or if that's something that she was assigning retroactively, saying, oh, I was told this thing when I didn't know, you know, what sort of fate was laid out for me to become this godlike person.
It almost doesn't matter, though, right? The fact that she thinks or created a story that somebody told her she was president, that's all this has the same conclusion in some way.
Exactly. Yeah. There's this sort of divine whispering in her ear saying, you know, I know you're just putting your kid to bed right now, but there's really this bigger thing that's ahead for you. And I think that's an early prediction of that. You know, I think it's also important, like you say, you point out the stature of this person. Amy was not a particularly political person growing up, and neither was her family. Many people in the family didn't even vote. So, but I think what you're right, she's tapping in on, like, that is one of the most well-known people on the planet, and that's what she wanted to be.
Hmm. Okay, let's step away from Amy's story for a moment and talk a little bit, as you do in the book, sort of the origins of some of these ideas, these New Age movements. One of the things you write about is the earlier history of these movements. Early in the country's history, it was this new thought movement. Mm-hmm. Explain what that is first.
Yeah, so New Thought, you know, I'm not a professor of this stuff, but from what I can understand is New Thought was emerging at a time when people were coming to America realizing that this was a place that they felt that they could create their own Garden of Eden, essentially. Yeah. You know, they were escaping the sort of binds of a restrictive government in England and coming here and starting fresh. Looking past the fact that there were already people who lived here, they thought this could be their own religious utopia. So you started to see movements like the Shakers and people in New Thought coming up with ideas where it was spirituality, but it had alternative power structures mm-hmm. to it. And particularly around with women, you know, in a lot of traditional religions, even today, you don't see a ton of power imbued upon women. And with some of these, you know, early philosophies and spiritualities, women were not only powerful, but they were, you know, intensely spiritual. They could receive messages from beyond and things like that. So in the, you know, early 1800s, the late 1700s, that's when you start to see a lot of this thought happening, specifically in New England, with a lot of these new settlers coming in and setting up utopian religious communities that are based upon these alternative spiritualities.
Well, we're in Utah, so obviously people here are going to say, that sounds like the Mormons, and you mentioned how Joseph Smith sort of comes out of this New Thought movement as well.
Right. You know, having spent so much time researching Joseph Smith, it was really interesting to see that he was certainly not the only guy with ideas like this at the time. He was a part of a really big cultural shift that where people were saying, you know, I've got this kind of ability to speak to God or speak to saints and angels and spirits, and I have these alternative methods. You know, Joseph Smith famously looked into the hat and saw the seer stones and, you know, could interpret the golden tablets. That was in a way not really unique. I think that there was a lot of that sort of practice happening at that time and in that specific place.
I think what's also interesting about that moment, and that seems kind of outrageous for the time, is that a lot of these believers in this New Thought movement you write about in the book centered on this idea that God is everywhere in all things and all people.
Mm-hmm.
And this was appealing to women because God could be feminine as well as as masculine. How much of these ideas were, I don't know, a response, if not a corrective, to the treatment of how women were feeling in American society, do you think?
I think that it's a huge response. I mean, I was very surprised in my research when I found that many of, you know, early suffragists were talking about spiritualist ideas. Mm-hmm. There's at the time, you know, in the 1800s, there was a lot of people talking about, you know, spiritualist mediums and things like, you know, rapping on a table or you know, sounds that you could interpret as like messages from spirits. That was literally happening among, you know, major feminists at this time. They were people who were fighting for their rights, who were saying we deserve a place at the table in terms of our decision making and what our lives look like and how we vote. But they were also very tuned in to this spiritualism movement. And I think that surprised me because, you know, I think as a journalist, and I wasn't seeing a lot of scholarship, a lot of journalistic scholarship around the New Age movement. I think it's because it's really disregarded as something kind of wooey and out there and like whatever. People are talking about psychics and mediums. What I found was that people have been talking about psychics and mediums, especially within feminist circles, for a very long time. And I thought, well, that's interesting because that means that there is a culture here that has long wanted something and is seeking to create it.
You know, I think this is so helpful to be able to understand what's behind these ideas. On this one hand, okay, so part of it was women and their response to what was going on. But then there's this other idea and a number of these other ideas. One of them you mentioned was that by about 1870, there were something like 8 million spiritualists in the United States at the time. Probably not quite that many, but, you know, a lot, like maybe even several million anyway. And one of the things you say is during the Civil War or after the Civil War, you describe this chasm had started to form in the country and that people were touched by loss. Mm-hmm. And that here's how you put it in the book. Spiritualism was an antidote for a place that felt irreparably broken. So we'll talk about the role of fear, but people are turning to spiritualism because things seem like and this will seem relevant to today, things seem like a mess.
Yeah.
And so spiritualism seemed to be a way to make sense of it or maybe even repair it. Does that seem right?
Yeah, I think so. I think that, you know, you read about things like the Civil War in history books and you can understand the facts of it. But what I started to realize in doing this research was like that real human feeling of like all these people went to war and so many people were killed and people just couldn't get their arms around so much destruction and loss and everything just felt so bad. And I think, you know, modern experience tells me, you know, when things feel really bad, it is a very human quality to reach for something to help soothe that feeling, to give you answers. And spiritualism was doing that. And it was, you know, people were offering their services saying, you know, I can connect you with your son who was killed or your husband, and you can speak to them one last time. And people wanted that. You know, it was very popular. And I think that's what explains it, is that it's just, you know, very rampant pain that everyone was feeling and wanting something to soothe that.
There's another part of the history we have to talk about, I think, to understand Amy's story and the larger story, and that is the role of lost places, the legends of places that vanished. And you begin the book with the legend of Lemuria. Now, some may know what that is. Explain this legend and your kind of interesting diversion into the world of lemurs, which is also was kind of a delightful part of the book.
Oh, I'm so glad. Yeah. When I started this book, it was to try and understand this culture around crystals and tarot cards, and that was pretty much it. What I didn't realize was just the depth of myth-making within the New Age space. So most people, I think, have heard of Atlantis, this idea of a lost civilization, and the reasons it's lost, you know, are myriad and you know, diverse. Lemuria is sort of like that. What started the Lemuria story was much more recent, whereas Plato is who we have to thank for Atlantis. Right. Lemuria actually came about in the 1800s, and essentially a man was writing about lemurs, these, you know, cute little, you know, primates. Yeah. At that time, people had found lemur fossils in India and on Madagascar, and What this writer was trying to understand was, how could you find these species so far apart? There's a whole ocean between where they are. So what he floated in an academic journal was this idea that there had been a continent in that ocean called Lemuria that had simply fallen into the ocean and was gone. And that was what explained the species distribution. And in his paper, he said, I'll call it Lemuria. Let's just float that as the name of this place. Well, this is before scientists, you know, accepted continental drift and plate tectonics and knew that a landmass cannot just drop to the bottom of the ocean. That just doesn't happen. You know, land rises and falls, but that's pretty much the extent of it. And even when this writer, Philip Lutley Sclater, when he died, he did say towards the end of his life, yeah, that Lemuria theory was basically no good. But at that point, like many things, the genie was out of the bottle. And people were like, oh my God, there was a lost civilization. And people, specifically within the New Age movement, started to kind of impress upon Lemuria this idea that there was a spiritually enlightened people that lived there and that they could, you know, had all these special qualities to them that made them, you know, better than the average human. And so it became all this folklore and mythology around it. And that remains today. There, you could say to some people, you know, I was a Lemurian in a past life, and to certain people within the New Age movement, that would kind of hold a level of cachet. Oh, whoa, you were a Lemurian. You must be really enlightened.
What does Amy say about Lemuria? Because she comes to adapt that into her own kind of, what, spirituality or ideology.
Yeah, or even just the myth-making around herself. So at a certain point, Amy started to call herself Mother God, like I said, but she would say that she had been reincarnated several hundred times and that in her past lives, she had been Joan of Arc, she had been Marilyn Monroe, she had been the Queen of Lemuria. And when I heard about this, I guess if I was to crawl into the mindset of a person who says they're a god and is telling a story about themselves, I guess I might understand that you would want touchstones that people understood, Joan of Arc or Marilyn Monroe. But I didn't know what Lemuria was. I didn't know what that would mean. And that's kind of what sent me on this research journey to understand what the heck Lemuria is. And it was a big part of her story, this idea that in a past life she had been this queen of this civilization and that civilization had been lost, but she had, her spirit had endured.
As you write about it, Lemuria, she said, had defended itself all these years ago, 27,000 years ago, in this big great battle with a violent adversary. Called Atlantis. There she throws Atlantis into the story. That idea of a battle, the idea of her battling for the soul of humanity, that seems like a theme you hear from time to time in these stories.
Mm-hmm. And specifically with Amy, I mean, I think that she really set herself up in her life that people needed to do what she said and not ask questions because she was really the vanguard protecting humanity from the invasion from, you know, these groups like the Illuminati and the Anunnaki and these sort of other, you know, evil species she would talk about. So that was really her thing. She had, you know, whereas in many New Age spaces, you see sort of this love and light mentality, very enlightened type people speaking in that kind of New Age guru speak. Amy was really aggressive. She was very combative and yelled at her followers and was really the opposite of what I've just described. And I think that this is part of why she could justify that, is that she was a warrior and that she needed to be listened to because there was a battle happening.
Leah Sotili, we're talking about her book, Blazing Eye Sees All, Love Has Won, False Prophets, and the Fever Dream of the New American Age. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West and Buck Fabrizio. Today in the program, the journalist Leah Sotili is back with us. We talked with her a few years ago about Lori Vallow and Chad Daybell. They're the couple who twisted their Mormon beliefs into this dark doomsday theology. This time, Sotili has a different spin on extremism. This one is a digital cult that taught about past life reincarnations in galactic starships and a cosmic mother god who had incarnated on Earth in the form of a woman named Amy Carlson. Sotili is working out how the need for answers and hope has made some open to anything, even these really dangerous fantasies. The book is called Blazing Eye Sees All. The term New Age, you say, is literal, that New Age seekers shared this idea that there could be a new era of human history. And in some ways, it's kind of like the reason this is appealing is everything around me sucks. And so I'm looking for a reset, whether it's in their personal lives or in the sort of the political, you know, atmosphere or whatever. But they want someone who comes up with something, you know, new. Let's reset this. Let's restart that. That seems to be at the heart of, at least if I'm understanding what you're writing about in the book, the New Age movement.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's, you know, it's a reaction to some religious movements that are more apocalyptic, you know, the Book of Revelation that, you know, have this sort of like gloom and doom that has to happen before some sort of spiritual, you know, enlightenment or salvation. I think that the New Age literally is expecting a rebirth, just like would be prophesied in like the Book of Revelation, but it's a better one. It's like a more optimistic one. And I think that that's both societal and it's for humanity, but it also can be really personal. You know, on your march toward humankind ascending to a better place or a more enlightened dimension, to get there on this path, you become personally enlightened. You start changing the way you think and act and exist in the world. So it's a both, you know, deeply personal movement leading towards something greater for everyone.
What did Amy have? What was her gift? What is it that drew followers to her? Was it her charisma? Was it her ideas? Or was it just sort of in part that she had managed to understand how to get her ideas, her beliefs out into the world through the internet and, you know, these live stream videos? Like, what was it that – I mean, she never became wildly famous, but she did draw some people to her. So what was it about her, do you think?
I mean, I think in part, at least in the earlier days of her being Mother God, she did have a lot of charisma. She was this sort of, you know, had that yoga glow to her that you see. Yeah. Like, she just seemed very natural and healthy and let's live in community, let's live near the land. Things that I think are very familiar to us. So she was appealing to a lot of people. I think that she was someone who had a lot of ideas and she could speak with a lot of conviction about astrology, for example. Mm-hmm. That was a big thing for her. She would do these constant forecasts online where she would wear this little headset and she would say, here's, you know, the astrological predictions for the day. She did that constantly. And I think even more than her ideas or her charisma was just her pure ability to saturate the internet with herself. Hmm. And you know, there's a lot of people out there looking for things online and they would find her and she would engage with those people directly and she would chat with them and they would watch her live streams. And so I think that was it. It was just a lot of her for a long time. But down the line, you know, she started talking about that God was a woman.
Yeah.
And that, I think, was probably her most attractive belief for people to say, oh my God, this woman is finally talking about what I've always known, that God is feminine, that God is a woman. So she sort of came out seeming like she was a very feminist thinker. You know, in reality, she was very much the opposite of that. But that was really appealing to men and women who said, yeah, I see God differently, and this person is talking about it, and she seems like a great person.
In your last book, When the Moon Turns to Blood, you tell the story of Lori Vallow. And she's a woman at the center of this really troubling spiral of belief, becomes really ugly and dark and really violent. What is the relationship or the connection, if any, between Lori and Amy, if there is one?
Yeah, I think that I'm very interested in the ways that women try to take power for themselves. Yeah. And what this has manifested in the two books that I've written is writing about women who've done that in really scary, controversial ways. I do think that it is in part what Lori Vallow was trying to do was claim some sort of spiritual power for herself.
Yeah.
But she was also someone who had deep mental illnesses and went about it in a way that was almost hard to believe is real. I think Amy Carlson, you know, I don't know of any violence in her past, but this is somebody who was also trying to carve out a space for herself. I think one common trait between the two of them is this real need to be revered, to be famous, to be a celebrity. You know, I often wonder if Lori Vallow is getting a little bit of what she wanted with – it's not the way she wanted it, but she does still think of herself. You know, you see these interviews she's been doing from prison.
Yeah.
She sees herself as a martyr, as someone who will be exonerated and who's right, and, you know, arguably would be on that spiritual path that she set out for herself. I think Amy Carlson was very much of that same mentality.
I don't think this will be a spoiler. Amy Carlson died in April of 2021. I mean, she was young. She was only 45. How do you understand that? Here's a person who is talking about sometimes anyway, the, you know, the dangers of GMO crops and toxins in the food supply and, you know, big pharma and other crazier theories. But someone who you'd think would be tuned into health, and she died emaciated. Her body had this blue tint to it, which you can talk about if you don't mind. Mm-hmm. Like, how do you make sense of where she ended up?
I think that it's very tragic what happened to her. I mean, she died in this horrific way. She was someone who had severe alcohol disorder at the end of her life. She, you know, had severe eating disorder. She also was drinking an ungodly amount of a substance called colloidal silver. Yeah. I talk about what that is in the book, but in briefly, it's a really, you know, alternative health snake oil. Yeah. I can't call it.
It's been around for a long time. Yeah.
It's been around a long time. And it's something that, you know, everybody thinks of that, you know, drinks it as that it could cure anything. Yeah. You know, whatever you've got, it'll cure it. And really, it's made from batteries. Right. And so Amy Carlson and her followers were producing and selling this stuff. And she was, you know, the biggest consumer of it. And it, you know, essentially, you know, killed her liver and it turned her body blue. You know, to me, it felt like the worst case scenario of the alternative health movement, and this which rides right alongside New Age ideas. There's a big reason why people seek alternatives in terms of how they manage their health, whether it's, you know, the insurance system or the healthcare system, a lack of access to healthcare, a lack of trust in scientists and doctors. Amy was all of those things. And she told her followers, you know, I'm never going to a doctor. I will take care of myself, and we should all do that. You know, what's really unfortunate is she got very, very sick. And towards the very end of her life, she did ask her followers to take her to a doctor. And they said, are you kidding? We would never. You never wanted that. You're talking crazy now. And what's really unfortunate then is that she didn't get any medical help for something that she was asking for. And so I do talk about in the book how it almost feels like she set up this game, and then when she wanted to leave the game, she couldn't because her followers kept her in it. And I think that that's really sad.
It's hard to read the chronicle of her last moments there in Ashland in this log cabin-styled hotel, laying there in the shower. Someone spraying water on her. She's 75 pounds, I think. Mm-hmm. And then she sort of loses control. It sounds like the movement, her followers sort of take over, and after she does die, they continue to sort of observe the corpse. They wrap her body in this sleeping bag, drive her into the woods. It's at this point that the authorities become involved. The, you know, group members are accused of mishandling the body. What do you make of all of that? That's a really tragic part of an already strange story.
It's a harrowing. It's absolutely awful. But I also think that it shows the level of their belief that Amy was a god, that she was the center of their lives, of their ideas, of everything that they had left their own lives behind. So when she died, you know, she would talk, as many New Age leaders have, she would talk all about ascending to the fifth dimension, to 5D. You know, when she died, her followers were not sure what that would mean. Right. Was her body literally going to disappear? Was it going to rise up into the sky? What was going to happen? And what happened was nothing. Right. So they did for you know, quite a while, they did try to understand, you know, was there something greater at play here? But I think, you know, at the end of the day, then they just had a dead body on their hands. And what they decided to do was a pair of her followers drove her body from Oregon all the way to southern Colorado, so crossing many state lines. And they brought her back to the home that the Love Has One group lived in, and they assembled her body in the middle of a shrine and kept it like that. So they were worshiping her in a way that is very difficult for you or I to understand. And I still don't totally understand it. Yeah. It's a really hard thing to see when those police go into the house and realize that there's these people with a couple of children. They're living with a dead body in the house.
Well, a mummified, let's put it this way, blue corpse.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's really something. And I take these words from a person who has seen a lot of weird things in my career as a journalist. When I saw the body cam footage of those police going in, I don't think my mind could quite compute what I was seeing. Yeah. And I think that just shows really how outrageous it was and how, I guess, you know, there are people, this book is proof of that really are willing to take their beliefs to ends that I can't quite understand. But all of those people that followed Amy Carlson started off just like Amy Carlson. You know, there were people who were attorneys. There were people who were, college educated, people with careers, people of all ages, all races and genders came there to live with her. And not all of them were okay with living with a dead body in the house, but some of them were. Yeah. And it's, you know, this whole book is sort of a study in how that could possibly be true for someone to want to live in that situation.
Leah Sottile, her book is Blazing Eye Sees All, Love Has Won, False Prophets, and the Fever Dream of the American New Age. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the journalist Leah Sottile. We're talking about her book, Blazing Eye Sees All. I think people are going to want to know what sort of relationship the ideas here in the Love Has Won movement has to do with, like, Q or any of those other conspiracy theories or because we should also mention there's a darker side to all of this. There's a lot of anti-Semitism in here. There are a lot of other darker, problematic, racist, and ugly ideas in there as well. You want to say something about that?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that, you know, it's one part of Love Has Won that is I'm a little disturbed isn't talked about more, because this is a group that, you know, has had a documentary made about them and things like that, is that the catalyzing beliefs of this group were anti-Semitism, that, you know, the belief in a new world order that is run by Jews. This is like a QAnon cult driven by, you know, point to a conspiracy theory and they believed in it. And that wasn't just something being talked about in a random house in Colorado. Love Has Won's primary function was to live stream up to 6 hours a day online, specifically on Facebook, trying to recruit people and get them on board with these ideas. Many of the people who joined the group because they saw it being discussed in 9/11 truther forums, in forums about lizard people and anti-Semitic, you know, spaces. So that, I think that is one part of this group, is that New Age ideas are not always anti-Semitic, but there is a long history of them being that way. And that can't be overlooked with this. And again, going back to Amy Carlson's early life, this is shocking for her family. This is not something that she grew up with. It's a thing that she learned online, and it was supported within this New Age culture.
The group's live streams after she died, they didn't stop. And you say after time, it seemed like the group would just go on without Amy because, as you write in the book, there was just too much money to be made. So there's certainly that angle as well.
Right. Yeah. The group sort of fractured into a few pieces. But, you know, in the immediate aftermath, they continued live streaming because they had long talked about Amy ascending. And she did.
Yeah.
And, they could say she ascended. She's not here anymore. So on to the next point of business, which is whatever today's QAnon update is, or whatever, you know, President Trump is saying that they wanted to support. They're very, very pro-Trump. When the group fractured, it just split off into new incarnations of Love Has Won. So mm-hmm. new brands, you could say, that did live streams and sold colloidal silver and did astrology updates and talked about QAnon. When I interviewed Amy's family, they said they continue to see merchandise produced with Amy's face on it, that she is sort of like figurehead, I guess, to some people within this more conspiratorial New Age movement.
When Amy got up from that Mexican restaurant in Houston and walked away, she left her kids. She had occasional conversations with them later, but never really reconciled. And you write about her kids. Her son Cole said something that was interesting. He said that what had happened to his mom, to Amy, was, he said, the result of a failure of multiple systems and, as he put it, the way America puts people on a pedestal. What did he mean by that?
I think he was speaking to that idea that we've discussed, that, you know, you grow up in America and you have celebrities in your face. You know, it just depends on who your family reveres. And I think that that's part of what he was saying, is that his mother grew up thinking the best thing she could do was become famous, that she could become a famous singer. And when she couldn't hit that mark, when she couldn't become a singer beyond her local karaoke bar, she had to find something else to do. And it turned out it was pretty convenient to just become a god of her own making. And there is a huge history in America that allows people to do that. So that's what Cole was speaking to.
You say that there's this lie at the heart of, this is how you put it, the performance in a movement like Love Has Won. And it's based on what you describe as this legacy of belief in America, a place that, as you say, allows people to lie if they say it's in the name of their God. You want to say more about that?
Yeah. In part of the book, I talk about a Supreme Court decision called United States versus Ballard. Yeah. Without getting into the intricacies of it, it had to do with a group that was around in the 1930s through the 1950s called the I Am Activity, which was essentially claiming that they could heal people of their ailments through the mail, through things they were selling in the mail. And ultimately, that they were sued and they reached the Supreme Court, who said, you know, if people believe in these things, then who are we to say, as Supreme Court justices, whether or not that's real? And it essentially gave people selling snake oil a free pass to say, well, that's a part of my religion. And so that's a bit what I'm speaking to there at the end of the book, is that this idea is very American, to create yourself into a kind of god or celebrity, but it's also supported by the American legal system. When you say, this is my religion, this colloidal silver or this, you know, psychedelic substance is a part of that, it does allow people to predate on other people for their own benefit in the name of religion.
Let's go back and connect this story to the early history that we were talking about, New Age spiritualism that, you know, emerges in the 19th century. Is what happened with Amy, is this how a lot of these movements also end? And I don't mean in the same way, but that they seem to kind of build up to some absurd climax and then kind of fade away? Or do you think the material difference of this time, you know what I mean by that, the digital era, the internet era, the conspiracies being cultivated online, does that make Amy's story or this movement different?
You know, I want to say that so many of these New Age leaders of the past built to a point, you know, and faded away, but I really don't think that they did. You know, in a way, the lineage of the New Age is a lineage of intellectual theft. You just see, when the torch is dropped by one leader, it's just picked up by somebody else, given a slight repackaging, new logo, and then we're off to the races with the same ideas. I do think that, like anything in extremism, this, you know, far right, far left, whatever you want to call it, within these ideologies, the internet has accelerated everything. It just makes it so much more available. So whereas back in the day, I might not have been able to attend a spiritualist medium session or, you know, go to a meeting talking about the, you know, harmonic convergence. That's so available now. And Amy proved that, because her group was spreading their messages on Facebook. They were getting in the comments of forums and talking to people directly. And in a movement that is so much about improving yourself and giving you personal power, I think that that's so attractive right now online. I think that there's an audience out there Googling late into the night how to figure out, you know, how to fix their lives. And there are people like Love Has Won waiting to offer them an answer.
Leah Sottile, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Leah Sottile, her book is Blazing Eye Sees All, Love Has Won, False Prophets, and the Fever Dream of the American New Age. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER90.1. We're on Instagram at Radio West. Or you can just email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Our intern is Aidan Oneida. The program is produced by Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.